This is Calvin F. Hawkinson starting dictating tape number 4 on March 10th, 1995, giving my various comments and observations from starting with scrapbook number 3, page 39, and notebook number 36, page 19. The counter on the tape recorder was at 220. As I left off on the previous comments about the Jake Resnick murder, I was commenting about Ev Franson, the chief in Golden Valley, who was kidding me about moving the car to get it into Golden Valley so he would have jurisdiction rather than the Minneapolis Police Department and myself as investigator. I told him that I could prove that this wasn't the case because there had been a brief shower earlier in the evening, and under the car in which the body was situated was dry, and if I'd moved the car, it would have been very apparent that it had been moved. We questioned various people about this murder, people kind of on the fringes of the so-called underworld or organized crime, without any concrete results. And the murder was never solved, although we strongly suspected Yeti Blum. If he didn't do the murder himself, which is very unlikely, he probably arranged to have it done by some hitman. The case was never solved, at least as far as I knew. In the future. On page 41, there is a letter, and receipt from St. Cloud, Minnesota, which indicates that I sat on an oral board for a police lieutenant up there and received $25. For my services. What I did on all these oral boards I sat on for various departments and various examinations, and later on for lectures that I did for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and their police schools, I reported all this income on my income tax and paid the taxes on it. And in the future, this resulted in my being eligible for minimum Social Security. I qualified for Social Security with the amount of service, including all these exams and lectures, by winding up being 2 years over the minimum to qualify for Social Security. On retirement, this was helpful, of course, in building up my income, the minimum amount. Pages 41 and 42, there are clippings about an abortion case. This was one where we found out who had referred the girl, and one of the referrals people was an attorney, and I questioned him, and he admitted referring it, and hence the charge of abortion against him. This was unusual to have an attorney who is knowledgeable in the law to admit a serious charge of this nature. Also on page 42, there's a story about Chief Milton E. Winslow leaving St. Barnabas Hospital, where he'd been confined, and a story that concerns him probably resigning or resigning from the position. On page 42, there's a picture of him leaving the hospital, and with him is Earl A. Larson. And Earl was a fellow who was at Minnehaha Station when I came on the department, and was a patrolman assigned to the same shift I worked. On page 43, there's clippings and stories about two policemen accused of stealing whiskey. They eventually pled guilty to burglary, and of course they were immediately suspended and their position, police officers, was they were fired and it was terminated. On pages 44 through 49 are clippings concerning the story where two hold-up men killed a bar patron down on East 15th Street and just off Nicollet Avenue, and they escaped and went down to Iowa, Omaha, Nebraska, and Council Bluffs, Iowa, where they got into other trouble. They held up a tavern and killed a liquor store proprietor and wounded two people over the across the river in Council Bluffs. The articles in the preceding pages give all the details. I went down to Iowa with after they were caught with Detective Cronquist, and took statements from Brown and Kelly, the two men who committed these crimes, and brought them back to Minnesota. Minnesota was going to prosecute, but Iowa had the and Nebraska had the more serious cases and first crack at them, because they made the arrests, and they had the death penalty in Iowa. They were tried there, and eventually Brown and Kelly wound up being hanged in the state of Iowa. Brown was the last man to be hanged in Iowa in modern history. On page 50 and 51, there are stories concerning the appointment of Northside Captain Kenneth Moore, as police chief. The former chief, Milton Winslow, resigned for health reasons. He had a stroke, and he didn't feel his health was good enough to come back to be superintendent of police. And Captain Moore was appointed police chief. There also is some additional articles about the two men captured down in Iowa for the bar holdup here in Minneapolis, and the murders down in Iowa and additional holdups. On page 57, there are articles concerning the death of Inspector Charlie Wetherill. Charlie Wetherill was one of the great policemen and detectives in the Minneapolis Police Department history. He had numerous informants, and if he got on the case, he usually wound up solving it. He was a very fine gentleman and a good boss to work for. I worked very closely with him from way back when he and I went down to Texas to bring back Boyko, a young fellow who had killed his wife. We traveled together at that time. I have on this page also it states that I will be appointed acting inspector of detectives to replace Charlie until a permanent appointment is made. We will miss Charlie and his expertise, his contacts, and his relationship and ability to develop informants and receive information from them will handicap the Minneapolis Police Department considerably in the solving of future cases. On pages 58 and 59 concerns an incident at south of the border bar where a fight with a customer and ended up by Henry Saves wounding the customer as bouncers were attempting to eject him from the bar. Saves has had other brushes with the law, and we had two detectives from the auto squad, Russ Stenberg and Bill Petola, who were in the bar at the time, at closing time. They attempted to intervene, apparently, but it was happened so quickly, and they were unable to take any action before it was all over. On page 62, there are articles concerning my appointment to detective inspector, and on the following pages, 63, 64, and 65, are letters from various people, letters of congratulations on my appointment. On page 65, there's a little article concerning Naflin to appoint a new police chief in a week. He had just won the election, city election, and he was going to announce a selection of a police chief. On pages 66, 67, there are articles concerning his appointment of Jack L. Puterbaugh, formerly liquor inspector for the state of Minnesota, liquor control agency head of the state of Minnesota, as chief. On pages 68 through 73 concerns the trials and tribulations of Jack L. Puterbaugh as Mayor Naflin's appointee as chief of police. There was a lot of opposition in the council and from other sources to his appointment, and eventually Puterbaugh withdrew as candidate for chief. On page 74, 75, 76, and 77 are articles concerning the reappointment of Pat Walling as superintendent of police. He had been chief previously, and then went back to inspector of police while Captain Moore was chief. On these pages concerned various personnel shifts in the department after the appointment of Pat Walling. I remained as inspector of detectives under his leadership and regime, and this pleased me very much because I enjoyed the job and thought I did a very good job of handling the position prior to Walling's appointment. On page 79 and 80 were various airline tickets and other souvenirs of my first Chiefs Conference, which was held in Montreal, Canada. The Minneapolis Police Department always sent the Chief of Police and the Inspector of Detectives to the Chiefs Conferences. My predecessor as Inspector of Police and former Chiefs had always said that attendance at the International Conference of Chiefs of Police Association was excellent preparation for and helpful to your duties as Inspector Detectives and Chief of Police. You met all your peers from around the United States, and the fact that you knew them personally meant that you could call them on the phone, get information from them, get personal favors from them, which would help you in your position as Inspector Detectives or Chief of Police. We had an enjoyable time, and it was a very enlightening time for me as attending my first Chiefs of Police Conference. I met many, many contacts from throughout the country who would be helpful in the future to assisting me in my job. On page 82 and 83 in scrapbook 3 is some clippings about a axe murder that happened up at 95 North 17th Street. And there were two victims, a Dorothy Day and Thomas A. Rogers. I received a call at home to come down to the headquarters that this axe murder had taken place. And from there I went to the scene with Detective Captain Joe Rosinko. And went into the apartment and found the two bodies lying on a bed. They were both had multiple axe blows that were visible on their bodies. They were both partially clothed and nude from the waist up. The interesting thing about the wounds was that rather than the wounds being of the sharp end of the axe, the wounds were made by the blunt end of the axe and rectangular marks of the blunt end of the axe were visible all over the bodies. While checking the scene and the bodies closely, we noticed on the abdomen of the female there were some shiny grayish splashes of material on the abdomen, and we thought probably that it might have been semen, but we weren't sure until later lab tests showed that this was true. After assigning detectives to the scene and consulting with the Bureau of Identification, Frayne Johnson, and giving him some orders and some items that we wanted taken care of, Captain Rosinko and I went back to headquarters with the prisoner and went up into the matron's quarters and started talking to him. We accused him of masturbating on the body of the girl, and he denied this, but apparently he didn't want to admit the masturbation part, but he readily admitted committing both murders. We called up a stenographer and took a statement from him in which he admitted using the axe to kill both of them. On page 84, there are some clippings about the Civil Service Commission requesting that examinations be held for detective supervisors, which in the past had been appointed by the chief of police and inspector of detectives. Also, there is a letter on page 84 from the wife of one of the men involved with a suggestion of how the incident should be handled to make it as palatable as possible. On page 85, there's clippings and a story about a babysitter admitting killing two babies. This was as a result of investigation by Scott County and Bloomington PD. Apparently a drunk arrested by the Bloomington Police Department tipped off Lieutenant Robert Pixley about the perpetrator of the two murders, and this resulted in his conviction. On page 86 in scrapbook 3, there are a series of articles concerning the painting of swastikas and other derogatory material on synagogues. And a youth was arrested and charged with these crimes and libeling Mayor Naftalin. These crimes and violations usually happened after some publicity about the country of Israel, or when other articles appeared in papers concerning prominent Jewish citizens of Minneapolis and the nation. Usually we couldn't find anything linking these individuals to any national organization or Nazi-type organization. usually, with few exceptions, they were individuals who apparently had strong feelings concerning the Jewish nation, Jewish people, and the Jewish religion. Also on page 86 was a clipping concerning the appointment of Russell D. and Donald Dwyer to a community protection squad, and they were to work against the type of individual and crimes committed against people of any race, religion, or ethnic background. As time wore on and there were long intervals between crimes committed against these type individuals and organizations and institutions, the two detectives in the community protection squad also worked against some of the active criminal gangs and tried to set up situations and investigated opportunities to try and put in a telephone tap or a bug at a meeting place, room, or some such type place where we could record conversations between individuals that were recognized as being active criminals and criminal gangs in the city of Minneapolis. On page 87, there's a article about Earl T. Anderson, who was a detective who had, in his off time, attended college and law school and was admitted to practice before the bar. He was suspended for either soliciting or getting a case somehow through his police connections. And rather than fight the thing, he resigned for personal reasons, and after that became an attorney in practice, or was an attorney in practice, at one time held later on positions of the city attorney in various suburban communities. On page 88, there is an article concerning the execution of Charles Noel Brown, one of the two individuals picked up in Iowa for a couple murders down there, plus they had been involved in crimes in the city of Minneapolis. Charles Kelly was previously executed in the state of Iowa, and that completed the action against these two individuals who were responsible for several murders and other crimes, mainly holdups in Minnesota and Iowa. On page 88, there's a newspaper clipping headed "Locksmith Finds His Tools Gone." And this was Jimmy Orr, who was a locksmith and a burglar. He worked closely with various other criminals making keys for locks for them, and giving them advice, and actually committing some burglaries. Later on, he was involved in several incidents that I'll relate further when we come to them. On page 89, there are a couple photographs of an oral board that was seated and conducted promotional exam in Bloomington Police Department. Clyde Sorensen, the chief of police in St. Louis Park, Larry Nelson, who was a highway patrol officer, and myself, along with members of Civil Service Board, conducted the examination. It was for some type of promotional exam, probably lieutenant or captain in the police department in Bloomington. I know I was selected because of my former association with Chief Hart in the Minneapolis Police Department. And by making appearances and sitting on many oral boards, my reputation had. I had sat on numerous oral boards in the Minneapolis area and throughout the state of Minnesota, and had gained a reputation for being fair, knowledgeable, and thorough in my examinations. And this, I believe, was why I was asked to sit on quite a few oral boards. Page 90 through 93, there are clippings concerning a young fellow who went on a shooting rampage in South Minneapolis. At 4917 Newton Avenue South, this called out numerous squads, and I was notified at home and went out to the scene. Ancient armored car that we had in the department was brought out there. Eventually, we were able to go in and get him, and an arrest was made, and he obviously was having mental problems. He did wound a couple officers with shotgun pellets. Neither of the two were seriously injured. One of them was Deputy Inspector Donald Nelson, the other was Carl Pearson. On page 95, there's a show-up blank with the name Lawrence John Matthew. And the only reason this is in the scrapbook is because he was a neighbor boy with whom I was acquainted. On page 95 through 97, there is clippings and stories about three youths indicted in beating death of a woman in the city. The woman was a Mrs. Danielski, and this was a very vicious crime. It started out as a purse snatch, apparently. And two of the three young fellows were on parole from St. Cloud Reformatory. John Byron, one of the individuals, had a hard cast on his hand, and apparently this was used in the beating. And this was one of the most severe beatings I had ever seen. The woman's face and head looked like a plastic bag of pinkish-red mush. And I was very upset concerning this crime, and very pleased that pickups had been made. This turned out to be a very controversial case, mainly because during the interrogation of White and Byron in my office by Detectives Short and Ryman, White, a juvenile, was promised by Detective Short and Ryman that he would, could, or would be prosecuted as a juvenile rather than as an adult. And we were tape recording the interrogation, and someone or somehow somebody in the department leaked this fact to the news media, and it came out in trial. And after the trial was over, a law professor at the University of Minnesota by the name of Yale Camazar used this case to against police generally and against police interrogations in his class presentations, and he gained considerable notoriety or fame in law school areas for having this tape. Eventually, with a second trial, Byron was convicted even without his confession, mainly by the good work of our assistant county attorney who would prosecute the case, who did an excellent job. The Byron White case continued to get publicity from time to time when confessions were discussed in law schools, and mainly because of Professor Camazar's use of the tapes in various parts of the country. On page 97 and 98 are clippings concerning the arrest of a LaVange Michael, Mrs. LaVange Michael in Rapid City, South Dakota for abortion. We got onto this case because a girl came into General Hospital receiving with a serious infection from the abortion, and she, after questioning her for a while, she admitted that she had had an abortion by Mrs. Michael in Rapid City. Mrs. Michael was recognized or named Gold Star Mother of the Year because she had lost one of her sons in service in World War II. She was very well known in Rapid City, and her family was well known and very prominent in the city. So it was quite a scandalous affair in Rapid City, and caused a lot of heat for the chief in Rapid City, though he had nothing to do with it, as the Minneapolis police got onto it through the girl getting an infection and reporting to the hospital in Minneapolis. As I remember the case, we didn't receive 100% cooperation from Rapid City until we put a little pressure on them, and then the case went forward rapidly. On page 100, there's an article about Charles Kelly dying in the gallows in Iowa, and along with Brown, he had paid the full penalty now for the numerous crimes that they had committed, including murders and holdups, both in Minnesota and Iowa. On page 102, there are some clippings and articles about a mobile patrol starting up in the Minneapolis Police Department. This was the type of squad or type of organization that was the predecessor to what was later called the Flying Squad, or the squads called out in special crimes and barricaded criminals. And when we have a special crime problem in a certain area, to give saturated patrol in that area to try and put a stop to the outbreak. On page 103 is a letter from Willard B. Morris, supervisor of the training division of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, about an appearance I made before their training schools. I continued to do this for the State Crime Bureau, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, for many years into the future, and it was a very rewarding and a very nice appearance that I enjoyed doing for a long time. On pages 104 through 106 are clippings and articles concerning the Keno Gray case, where a Patricia Bjergo was shot by Keno Gray. I personally went down to pick him up in Miami, Florida, and he admitted it readily to me, and a statement was taken down there. We flew back by Northwest Airlines, and without any problems in flying. At that time, we could carry firearms on a plane, and of course I was armed. We sat in the rearmost seat in the plane with Keno Gray next to the window, and I seated alongside him. I kept a very close watch on him, and even went so far as to go to the bathroom and watch him when he had to go. It was a little bit difficult because of the confined space, but we kept the door partially open, so I was able to watch him for any type of problem with him trying to pick up something to use as a weapon, or any other type of mischief that could possibly happen. Keno Gray was charged in this case, and convicted eventually, and he was sentenced from 30 to 80 years in Stillwater, Minnesota, Stillwater State Prison. On pages 107 and 108, there's a story concerning a ex-alderman and the landlord of a liquor store operator. The landlord being killed and the ex-alderman being wounded by a Michael Scavene, the liquor store owner. After Scavene was arrested, he brought to the city jail, and I immediately went up to talk to him with an interval of only about 15, 20 minutes because of a phone call that I had received that delayed me for that length of time. And I went up to the city jail to talk to him, wanting to get as much information as I could about Frank Walensky, the ex-alderman. Frank Walensky was alleged to have had control of any liquor store licenses in the city, and was able to get the license transferred into owners' names at various locations in the city. This apparently was behind the shooting, because Michael Scavene was talked into putting a liquor store into the property owned by Abraham Bloom, the landlord, and Frank Walensky was supposed to get a transfer of the license to a more suitable location, and apparently he was stalling or was unable to transfer the license, and this was what was behind the shooting. When I went up to the city jail to talk to Scavene, he had clammed up. He was talking and admitted the shooting prior to coming to jail, but after he got up there, somebody must have got to him and told him to shut up or to keep his mouth shut, because he never talked. And I'm sure he could have given us much information about how Frankie Walensky wheeled and dealed with licenses in the city of Minneapolis. Is 109, 110, and 111. There are pictures and brochures, literature concerning the 69th annual conference of the International Association of Chiefs of Police in St. Louis, which I attended with Pat Walling, his wife, and my wife. It was a very interesting conference, and picked up a lot of information, met a lot of various people that would be of use to me in the future as contacts, and enjoyed ourselves very much. On page 112 is an interesting story about an armed man captured in the 620 Club. All the facts behind the scenes are what are interesting. We had a community protection squad of two men, Don Dwyer and Russ D, who tried to find places to put in listening devices at the homes, rooms, or other places where burglary gangs and other criminals gathered, lived, and tended to talk about their crimes. They found out that a well-known burglar, Gary Goldberg, lived in the Buckingham Hotel on LaSalle Avenue South in Minneapolis, and that the manager of the Buckingham Hotel was a police buff and would cooperate with us any way possible to help us to install a bug, and he furnished the next door room to Gary Goldberg's room to us rent free, which is a big help because we had no funds to pay rent on the room. The room that the manager gave us next to Gary Goldberg's room was listed in the register as being rented by a contracting company for employees that had to stay overnight, because our intentions were, and we did have one detective in this room listening to the device and recording 24 hours a day, and we kept it in there for about 20-25 days. And this is a tremendous drain on manpower, of course, but we managed to do it. I installed the bug myself. I went up there on a Saturday morning, and on the wall adjoining Gary Goldberg's room, I drilled a hole, and the plaster was of a very gritty type plaster. And it made a lot of made a lot of noise when I was using the drill to drill the hole. So what I'd do was flush the toilet in the room next to Gary's, and then run quick and drill a few turns of the drill, and continued doing that off and on for about 2 hours. Until I thought I was getting close to, or almost to, the wall surface of the wall on Gary Goldberg's side of the partition or the wall that I was drilling through. And I flushed the toilet again, went over there and drilled a couple, two or three turns quickly, and I felt the drill kind of push forward easily, and I thought, sure, I had poked the drill into Gary's room and he would discover it immediately. Listened and tried to tell whether I had been discovered, but heard nothing, so I assumed everything was okay, and I cleaned out the hole and looked through there, and I found I had, with the kind of the screw tip of the drill bit, had just barely punctured the wallpaper on Gary Goldberg's side of the room. And so I was okay, and then I put some foam rubber around the opening, and put the microphone right up to the wall after piercing the wallpaper with needle holes, several of them, to let more sound in. And then packed more rubber insulation-like material around the wire coming out of the wall, and connected it up to our tape recorder and installed headphones and listened and found that it operated okay with people in the room. You could hear their voices clearly, and you could record everything that was said in that room. Over the next few days and weeks, we overheard many conversations, one of them being when Gary Goldberg had pulled a pay telephone off a telephone pole and was trying to get into the money box on the pay telephone. And he was trying to pick the lock and was having an awful time. He wasn't able to do it that way. And then he tried to pry it open, and apparently it was very well made, and because he never was able to get into the pay phone. Another conversation we heard was Jimmy Orr, the locksmith burglar, and Gary Goldberg discussing various places that they had cased for burglaries and holdups. One of them was the Zinsmaster Bakery, where Gary Goldberg had gone to the bakery and went up a stairway to the second floor where the offices were located, and applied for work there, asked for work, and while doing that, while he observed the open safe in the office, and that it would be easily available and could easily be held up, and the score would have been fairly high as far as the amount of money, according to the conversation we heard. It turned out about a year or two later that a holdup did occur at the Zinsmaster Bakery, and because of this information, I remembered it and was able to affect the capture of those responsible for the holdup of Zinsmaster Bakery very quickly, within an hour after it happened. And this resulted in a lot of good publicity for the department and for myself. Another conversation we overheard was the one concerning the 620 Club. They were going to, the burglars were going to put a man into the bar and restaurant while it was open, and he was to conceal himself, hide himself in the club, and then having a walkie-talkie radio, he was to radio the other burglars on the outside when the coast was clear, and to let him in the back door. He apparently hid himself in the bar, okay, and then in order to frustrate the burglars and to capture them while in the place, Don Dwyer and a couple detectives were across the street on Hennepin Avenue in the theater located there during the night the burglary was supposed to occur, and me and a couple other detectives went to the Essex Hotel located on 6th Street between Hennepin and 1st Avenue North, and we had a front room there where we could look right down at the alley behind the 620 Club and see the rear door very well. We planted there all night, and during the night, we observed Jimmy Orr, Gary Goldberg, and others walking back and forth on 6th Street and on Hennepin Avenue, time after time, but they never were able to make contact, apparently, with the man on the inside. And he was never able to get contact with them because they never got into the bar. And of course, the next morning, a bookkeeper came to the 620 Club to do some work, and he thought he heard some noise, so he called police. And that's when the police got there and searched the place and found the man hiding up in between the ceiling and up on the 2x4s or timbers that that ran holding the ceiling up. He had been laying there so long across these timbers that he couldn't move his legs. And when he was captured, he was dragged out by a patrolman who went up in there to get him out. And we later found out that he was permanently injured, and he never did regain complete use of his legs because he had lain up there for so long. The detective manning the listening post up there in where we had the bug next to Gary Goldberg's room heard telephone calls all through the night where Jimmy Orr and Gary Goldberg and another burglar were discussing what in the world had happened. We later found out that the walkie-talkie had failed and the man who is hiding in the 620 Club was unable to get in contact with the other burglars. They were very concerned about him and discussed what to do, and they finally decided that they were going to go down there, even though it was after daylight on Sunday morning, and go in the place and get him out because they wanted to save him. And they drove down there, but by that time the police had the place surrounded, and as soon as they saw the police, they drove away and came back to the Gary's room, where we heard more discussion on what could have possibly have happened. Later on, while the bug was installed at this location, we heard Jimmy Orr and Gary Goldberg and some other individual planning to go to Superior, Wisconsin, or Duluth, and to do a holdup up there, and that they were going to have their trunk full of arms and rifles, shotguns, and that they were going to pull this holdup. We notified Duluth and Superior and told them to be sure, and we gave them the license number of the car and the make and model that they'd be driving, and to be sure and not jump the gun, and let them